From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Later this month, a Westminster College symposium will examine what some are calling an epidemic of sexual violence on college campuses. In advance of that summit, we'll be joined today by Holly Mullen, Executive Director of the Rape Recovery Center, to hear about why sexual violence occurs and what is being done to address it on school campuses and in communities.
Almost 90% of sexual assaults take place between people who are acquainted. So they know each other to some level. They may know each other very well.
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines and political cornflakes coming up on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, a conversation with Holly Mullen, Executive Director of the Rape Recovery Center here in Salt Lake City. But first up, we have these headlines. Park City Mountain Resort will have to pay $17.5 million to stay open this winter during an ongoing court battle between two titans of the ski industry. The ruling is much closer to Park City's $6.6 million request than the $124 million that Vail Resorts Incorporated asked for in the case, raising hopes that the ski season will go on as regularly scheduled when snow falls this winter. Park City has said it might not be able to open this year if the bond was too high. A closure could have a devastating effect on the local economy. Judge Ryan Harris required Park City to post the bond within a week. The new ruling postpones an eviction Harris ordered in May after he decided that the resort missed a deadline to renew its decades-old bargain lease rate. A dinosaur discovered in Argentina weighed as much as 7 elephants when it roamed the Earth 75 million years ago. Researchers have named the colossal quadruped Dreadnoughtus, which roughly means fearless dinosaur. And at 85 feet long and 65 tons, the ancient creature was likely an imposing sight to behold. Some scientists are speculating that this dinosaur could be the largest ever verified. However, Salt Lake-based science writer Brian Switek says it's likely that even bigger dinosaurs existed. We just don't have the evidence to prove it.
There were bigger dinosaurs. We know that just from the size of some of these bones that were found, but they're usually from much scrappier skeletons in that you only have a couple of vertebrae and maybe a few rib bits and part of a femur or something else. That's the irony of these biggest dinosaurs. The bigger they were, the less there was to be preserved. You'd think they'd be these big, sturdy things that wouldn't break down, but they're so huge that it takes so much sediment to cover them that they're usually ripped apart by scavengers before they can really be buried.
While Utah is known for its wealth of dinosaur fossils, our state lacks the monster sauropods of Argentina. But Switek says Utah can stake claim to a similar beast of archaeological significance, called Dystrophius.
And this animal, even though it was much smaller than Dreadnoughtus or some of these Argentine giants, it was the oldest sauropod dinosaur that we know of in North America. This is about 160 million years old, Jurassic in age. So it kind of sets the body plan for some of the giants that came shortly thereafter, things like Diplodocus and things like that. So we might not have the biggest of the big, but we still have some pretty remarkable sauropods in our home state.
Dreadnoughtus' herbivore lifestyle and hefty dimensions are chronicled in the research journal Scientific Reports. Three women from Utah are running for Congress, and they're not all of the same political party. They gathered this week for a panel discussion about women in politics. So what did they have to say? Earlier today, I posed that question via Skype to Matt Canham, political reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune and one of the authors of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
So what they had to say is they want more women to follow their lead and get involved. This was a Women Power Politics event co-sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune that happened this week, and it brought together Donna McAleer from the 1st District, Luz Robles from the 2nd District, both of them are Democrats, and Mia Love from the 4th District, who's a Republican. And they had very similar messages. What they said is that women don't feel as engaged in the political process. They don't feel like they are asked to run for office. And part of it was that they feel that they're perfectionists, that they need to have more qualifications than men to jump in this arena. One of the quotes that Mia Love said was, "Step one, stop being so hard on yourself. Do not think you have to check 100% of the boxes in order to be qualified to do the job. Step two, Stop being so hard on other women. Too often we feel like if we're not qualified to do the job, we can't send someone else like us to do the job. This is a part of a bipartisan effort that has happened in this state to try to get more women engaged in politics. And it's not surprising that part of the reason they feel this way is that women are very underrepresented in politics in Utah.
Right. It's a very small percentage of women who are actually in state government, both here but across the country. Isn't that right?
That's right. When I was in Washington, D.C. as a Washington correspondent, there's not that many women senators. And there are these stories about the power of women senators as if there's some sort of newfangled thing. And this is in, 2014. Women have held and shown that they're capable in all kinds of positions. But for whatever reason, there hasn't been that critical mass of women who have moved into office where you look at it as they're 50% of the population. They should naturally be 50% of the political workforce as well. And they're just not right now.
Well, it says something about our culture and the culture that we've maybe inherited. And I guess we'll see as time marches on if we can fill the ranks of our government with more women. Well, moving on to other topics, what is the latest in the criminal cases against attorneys General Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow? What's the latest news there?
They do not want to be part of each other's case. And this is not a horrible surprise, but it is a major development. What happened is Mark Shurtleff's attorney filed a motion with the court on Thursday to separate his criminal case from that of Swallow. Now, they are both charged with multiple felonies involving potential corruption from their time in office. But Mark Shurtleff's attorney is saying that they are not anywhere near the same level of involvement. And he pointed out that all these charges are independent episodes. They're not episodes that they were both involved in. So on the early court appearances, these two attorneys general back-to-back who were both charged in corruption cases that are quite complicated have been going to court together. They're trying to say, look, we want to go our own separate path in court and then, see what happens as the process unfolds over the coming months.
Interesting stuff. Finally today, Matt, consultants are trying to figure out where to move the Utah State Prison. What have they come up with so far?
25 separate identified sites all along the Wasatch Front. So pretty much the prison could be anywhere. They're keeping these 25 sites under wraps at this stage because there's obviously a lot of politics that goes involved where a prison is. Most people don't want a prison in their own backyard. But there are areas of the valley that might be more amenable to it than others. What they're trying to say is we need a new prison in an area that's still close to the big population center in the Wasatch Valley and close to the facilities that provides, such as good access to hospitals or backup if there's some problem at the prison. Also, their workforce lives around here, so they don't want to move it way out into the boonies and then have to try to hire a brand new workforce who doesn't want to drive 100 miles away. So this complicates things. But what their plan is, they're going to take these 25 possible sites that are right now scattered through six counties around the Wasatch Front and narrow it down to just a couple by the legislature's start date in January. So this is going to be some major developments in this area. The hope that these consultants and the legislature have is to pick a location next year.
And so is the relocation of the prison a foregone conclusion? Is it a done deal? Just to remind our listeners.
Well, politics, who knows at this age? But right now the legislature said this year they are moving the prison from Draper. The property is too valuable. The city doesn't want it there. It's an old prison, so it needs to be reformed anyway. So the thought is, if we're going to make a brand new state-of-the-art prison, let's do it in a place that makes more sense to the valley. Because having it right in Draper just doesn't really work when you look at an urban planning scenario. So they're looking at sites also in Salt Lake County. We're not sure exactly where, but also in Box Elder, Davis County, Tooele, Utah, and Weber. Among those is where this is going to be. And we'll see when they narrow it down how the people from that area respond.
Wow. Well, and we will also see, I guess, during this next legislative session, what those potential sites could be if they unveil that. Matt Canham, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
No problem. You have a good day.
Matt Canham is a political reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune and one of the authors of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. You can find a longer version of this segment as well as a link to Political Cornflakes at our website, kcpw.org. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. One in five women in the U.S. is sexually assaulted while attending college. What is it that fosters a culture that allows these attacks to occur, and how can we address sexual violence on our campuses? A two-day symposium at Westminster College later this month looks to address these and other questions head-on. Right now, I'm joined in studio by Holly Mullen, Executive Director of the Rape Recovery Center here in Salt Lake City, which has partnered with Westminster College to shine a light on sexual violence, not only in the college setting, but also in our community at large. Holly, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Roger. It's nice to be here.
So that statistic, that 20% of women are sexually assaulted on college campuses, is astounding. How does that compare to the prevalence of sexual violence in our society at large?
I think the numbers that we're hearing from the college population, college-age population, are fairly accurate in comparison to what we see overall. It's actually more prevalent in, I'll use Utah statistics since that's what my agency tends to mostly get asked about. There was a survey done, unfortunately, it's 5 years old now, 6 years old, in 2008, statewide survey by the State Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, and it was only done with women. Women still are the main victims of rape and sexual assault,
right.
Although we do see more and more men coming forward with allegations of sexual assault. In Utah, over one in three women will be a victim of some kind of sexual assault during her lifetime, according to the results of this survey. And what that means, I always explain it to people. I think it's a shocking number by any standard, but it's also a spectrum that we talk about when we talk about sexual assault in a woman's lifetime. Could start with sexual harassment, inappropriate touching on kind of the one end here because it was behavior that was not consensual,
right.
And then goes along this spectrum all the way to rape.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it doesn't seem that unlikely that women would be a victim of this kind of behavior, one in three, when you look at those bigger numbers.
Dozens of universities are being investigated for how they handle sexual violence and harassment complaints. Is it that there aren't policies in place at these institutions? Is it that those policies are being ignored? Or, you know, why is it that universities seem to be, you know, we hear about it in the news enough that you would think that it seems that they're getting it wrong?
Right. What I'm learning, Roger, as I'm a student of this myself, as this topic gets more and more prevalent, most notably with President Obama's task force that came together to address this issue just about 6 months ago, I think what the main problem is there's really a patchwork of policies across the country at various institutions. Some, I would say, take it more seriously than others. It even ranges from the size of the university or the size of the college. In my study of this topic, some of the private universities seem to be more aware and have more progressive policies. And yet, some of the worst offenders are some of the Ivy League colleges.
Mm.
A lot has been said and written recently about some problems at Columbia University. I have a couple of friends, again, this is anecdotal, but a couple of friends who are professors at Dartmouth, spoken with them quite a bit about the problem on their campus, and they're both actively involved at Dartmouth in a policy setting group on sexual assault.
Right. So it can range, from public universities to private universities, it is to some extent everywhere. A question that I have about sexual violence in universities, but also, I guess, anywhere, is why does sexual violence and rape occur? Why does it occur?
That's good. I would say, again, it occurs in college campuses. There are probably a few. In fact, I know there were a few different factors in college and on campuses that might add to this problem. Nationally, or just in general, I have to go back to the very, very roots of why rape happens in the United States, in the world, actually,
mm-hmm.
because we know that rape is used all over the world as a form of control, a form of torture. And I believe so do most people who do this kind of work, that we have a culture. In shorthand, we often around our office call it rape culture. But what we mean by that is a culture that silences women frequently, encourages women's passivity, and rewards conquering behavior, especially on the part of males, conquest, conquering.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our organizational structures are still highly patriarchal, and we just have a culture that, and again, a very sexualized culture,
right,
on top of everything else.
So our culture enables this behavior to occur.
Exactly.
On the part of men. I'm wondering if we can talk about a little bit the resources that are available to people who are the victims of sexual assault.
Sure.
What should a person do if they are sexually assaulted?
Maybe I can start with a context a little bit, if you don't mind, a little bit about the mythology around rape and rape victims.
Please.
And go from there, because I think they're tied together. I think this ties in well with the campus epidemic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our society really buys into a huge mythology around rape and how it happens and who are its victims. First of all, the really easy ones to fight off right away, almost 90% of sexual assaults take place between people who are acquainted.
Mm.
So they know each other to some level. They may know each other very well. Rape is against the law in marriage in every state now. Very difficult to prove, and very rarely do victims come forward with that kind of a complaint. But
right,
when two parties are involved and there is not consent, it's rape.
Right.
So it can happen in marriage, happens frequently in dating relationships, people who just might know each other slightly, maybe coworkers. With children, we're well aware of teachers, scout leaders, ecclesiastical leaders being perpetrators. There's only about 8 to 10% of rapes that are actually done by a complete stranger.
Mm.
But we continue as a society to believe that's how it happens. We see it in our books, we see it in our movies.
Right.
And they do happen. And when they do, stranger rapes, they're extremely popular in the media. You know, it goes all over the news, and you know, everybody's freaking out because there's some stranger running loose.
Right. I guess, is that just because the anonymity creates more fear among, you know, people, and therefore it's something that if it bleeds, it leads? Kind of.
Exactly. And I also think that, you know, I often talk to people, reporters, or, you know, shows like this one, and I go away thinking, I have just been, you know, Sally Gloom and Doom, and I've been Holly the man hater and all of that. I don't ever mean to sound that way, because I don't see myself that way. But I also know that one of the reasons people continue to buy into a myth that this is a stranger on stranger kind of crime is we cannot be 100% safe. Women, or anyone, actually. We all know that, I think, somewhere in our brain. We can take precautions. You know, yeah, we can lock our doors. We can tell people where we're going. If we're headed out, for instance, on a date with someone for the first time, it would be a good idea to tell someone you're doing that, of course. And yet, if you don't, and you are sexually assaulted, it's not your fault. And really, truly, there was nothing that you could or should have done to not make that happen. We cannot be 100% safe. And I think why we go to the stranger myth is somehow that helps us believe that if we are assaulted or someone we know is assaulted, it just wasn't their fault.
Right.
The fact of the matter is, and this is another myth buster, no one deserves to be raped. Everyone has a right to safety and to be in control of their own physical body. And I think, again, this goes to this idea that if you become a victim, it's because you didn't take care of yourself. You didn't make sure you were safe, which is just a myth. As in, oh, you know, you dressed so provocatively.
Right.
You were asking for it. You might not have thought you were, but you really kind of were. Oh, you went home with a guy. Why did you do that? You know, don't you know better? Oh, you stayed out too late. Oh, you took a drink from someone and you really didn't know what was in that drink. Mm-hmm. It goes on and on and on.
The blaming,
forever.
The blaming,
yeah,
of the victim.
And I think we do that a lot so that we feel better about ourselves. Because the truth of the matter is, it can happen to anybody. And again, no matter what kind of precautions you take, people who are intent on raping and assaulting someone will always find a way to do it. They want to do it. They carefully can plan these rapes and attacks. They want to do it, and they will find a way if they want to badly enough, because it's about power and control by someone who doesn't have their own sense of power and control. They'd rather take it from someone.
Well, and that's interesting, because if, you know, you look at other crimes, property crimes, there's maybe a payoff in terms of monetary gain.
Mm-hmm.
Some violent crime is the result of, you know, who knows, crimes of quote-unquote passion, et cetera. But this is more about a power play. And does that happen because the perpetrators of these crimes believe that they're not going to be punished? Is there the sense out there among certain groups that rape is hard to prove, mm-hmm. or it's they can easily intimidate the victim,
yes.
as well?
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
Most cases are very hard to prove because this is a crime that typically takes place between just two people.
Mm-hmm.
We do hear about some really awful cases along the lines, gang rapes or the Steubenville, Ohio case with a bunch of high school kids standing around watching and right. bystanders just standing there. But most of them take place between two people. There are no witnesses. Yeah, there's frequently physical evidence, but it's very easy and again, I keep using women as the victim. Really, about 95% of victims are women, so I'll kind of use that for argument's sake. But it can go either way. In the case of women, there would be physical evidence, DNA, in a rape kit. The perpetrator often comes back and says, hey, it was consensual. Of course, of course I left bodily fluids, but, she said yes. And so it's a he said, she said sort of crime. Hmm. Becomes very difficult to investigate and to prosecute.
Okay, so it's true that some rape and sexual assault occurs against men, but 95% of it is against women. We like to think that the role of women is improving in society.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the sort of historic role of women in our culture and around the world, and even today around the world, women are, in a variety of traditions, mm-hmm. both religion and cultural traditions, they are, to some extent, subservient to the men and, property of the men. And this seems to be something that has allowed the kinds of crimes that we're talking about and
right.
the perpetuation of silence on the part of the victim. We're making gains, but the plight of women around the world is still very much present. Can you talk about how our own society and how women in society are making gains by leaps and bounds, but that we're at the same time fighting this historic cultural inheritance?
Right, exactly. That's another great question. I think let me take it down a little bit, maybe to the U.S. level and even Utah. I believe one of the big ways that we could see more attention to these kinds of crimes, as well as wider discussion about why they happen, would be to elect more women to public office. I'll use Utah as an example. Last year at the state legislature in the 2014 session, and the year before, we were able to, we meaning a large group of people who had an interest in domestic violence prevention, sexual assault prevention, child abuse prevention, kind of all of us got together, worked on a protective order bill for dating violence. That was two sessions ago. Just this last session, we were able to work with legislators. Primarily, they were women, I will have to say. We did have some male allies, but mostly women. Representative Jennifer Seelig carried the bill in the House. And this was to put in place statewide a victim's bill of rights in regards to sexual assault,
right.
including, though we didn't get this piece in this piece of legislation, we're working on this one this year, is to speed up the processing of rape kits,
yes.
That are nationally horrendously backlogged all over the country. So I think we get women in these more and more in these roles. We get more discussion about safety for women, prevention of sexual and domestic violence. And I think it makes sense that more productive and progressive laws would come out of having more women elected to offices. That's just one small example that I'll give you.
Well, let's actually just on that note return to what a victim of sexual violence, of rape, needs to do or should
you.
Do. If you are a victim of this, what is it that you should do and how do you get help?
Well, we have, the Rape Recovery Center actually has a 24-hour crisis line. You can access it from anywhere in the state. Often people will call that line shortly after they've been assaulted. And we have, again, round the clock, trained volunteers who can refer them out to what they need to do. I would also say it's really, really important to get to a hospital as soon as possible. So you either want to go yourself or have a trusted person go with you, or of course, report it to the police, mm-hmm. and police will either come to your home or wherever you are or meet you at a hospital emergency room. And when a victim goes there and reports, I've been assaulted, I've been raped, a whole system kind of starts kicking in. We have a 24-hour, the Rape Recovery Center has a 24-hour hospital response team. We'll send an advocate directly to the hospital to support and advocate for the victim during the rape exam. There's also a specially trained forensic nurse called a sexual assault nurse examiner who reports at the same time within, it's usually within about 30 minutes or less, reports their paperwork is submitted, filled out, consent has to be given, the victim has to give consent to have an exam. And then a rape exam is performed, and probably everybody's seen this on CSI basically, photographs, clippings of hair. These exams are very, very specialized, and they take typically, and there is no typical, unfortunately, no typical kind of rape, but they'll typically take about 4 hours. They have taken much longer than that. In fact, we had one just a few days ago that took 11 hours. There was extensive damage, extensive injury, and it was just a very long process. Mm. And then, of course, the kit is taken, put in a a safe box, and that's what we get when we talk about a rape kit. Photos, DNA, a lot of different kinds of evidence that goes to the state and crime lab.
You know, I know that the Salt Lake City Police Department has gone forward with a plan to test a backlog of rape kits around the country. As you mentioned, this is evidence generally that has been gathering dust on some shelf somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Potential evidence, though. I think the police would say that on occasion they go untested because, actually, let me back that up. I don't know their reasoning for not testing rape kits.
I'll give you one that's been frequent because we're working, and I mean people that I work with typically on advocating for sexual assault victims. Chief Chris Burbank has been pretty vocal about some of his issues with requiring all the rape kits to be tested. The task force that I mentioned a moment ago has unanimously, and it's a large group. We typically have about 20 people at the meetings, but there are about 30 or 40 on the task force. Mm-hmm. Unanimously, about 3 months ago, voted to recommend that we test every kit. Many police agencies are in agreement with that, but the Salt Lake City Police Department, led by Chief Burbank, has not come along. One of Chief Burbank's issues is that they don't all need to be tested because in many cases, as I mentioned earlier, the perpetrator and victim are acquainted somehow. And it's not, there's no question that sexual contact occurred. Mm. There's no question who the DNA belongs to because they're both saying, she's saying it was a rape. He's saying we had sex, but it was consensual. Mm. So there's no reason to burden the crime lab with an extra kit because we both know who, we all know who did it. We just need to know if it was a rape or not, find out. However, the comeback to that, and some of the sex crime detectives have mentioned this. If we take every kit and test them and enter what we know into this national database they have called CODIS, C-O-D-I-S. I never can remember what it completely stands for. But it's basically a tool that all law enforcement agencies can use across states to look for cold cases, to look for repeat offenders, to look for serial rapists. There are cities now that have made rape kit testing rape kit testing mandatory, have fed the information into the big database, and have gotten incredible hits on serial rapists and cold cases, and even homicides that began with rape and escalated in the process to a homicide.
So the idea is that even if it's between, which is the most common form, between people who know each other, the perpetrator of this rape could be somebody who has, and is likely, in fact, somebody who has raped before.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And again, here I go. Everybody thinks I'm like, you're so paranoid. But rapists will rape continually until they get caught and held to some kind of justice. Again, for all the reasons I've been talking about, I think it's a very easy crime to get away with, and it's very difficult to prove.
You mentioned the rape recovery crisis line or a hotline, I guess it is. What is that number?
801-467-7273. And we also have a website, raperecoverycenter.org. as well as a Facebook page that we put a lot of our, it's just Rape Recovery Center, we put a lot of our information up on that page. And again, I just want to, if I can get back quickly to the exam.
Yeah.
It's very important that as awful as a person feels after a rape, not to shower, not to douche, not to change clothes if possible. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is back in the day, maybe even just 10 years ago, victims were commonly told that they could only get a good DNA lift after 24 hours. It was too late. But now we've got such great technology around DNA gathering that we're now telling victims within 72 hours, mm-hmm. Even if you shower, please don't. But if you do, don't hesitate to still come in and have a rape exam done. Mm-hmm. And I'm also told now by some of the sexual assault nurse examiners that we're looking now at even 4 and 5 days out. So that's helpful. The Rape Recovery Center works with victims no matter where you are in the process of having been assaulted. So we deal with people, we assist people who were victims of childhood sexual assault, all the way up to someone who may have just been assaulted moments ago. We have a whole spectrum of services, and the ones that I've mentioned are typically what we would refer to as methods of crisis intervention. And I'll give our street address, but we're open Monday through Thursday to the public from 9 until 5. Mm-hmm. People can come in, walk in, people who are in crisis. And we actually have a couple of advocates who work full-time in the building to stabilize people who are in crisis. And that might mean they were just recently raped. It might mean they're having some kind of a flashback from a previous experience that they're just not being able to deal with.
Right.
And then once we establish kind of where they are on this spectrum of crisis, we will put them kind of more into a crisis counseling kind of model or into more longer-term therapy. And we have individual and group therapy programs at the center. All of our clinicians are licensed social workers, and so we also operate on a sliding fee scale so that we provide services to low-income and very low-income clients. So that's very helpful because I think otherwise people who couldn't afford private counseling would never get the services.
Well, we will put definitely a link to Rape Recovery Center on our website, as well as your address and
and
the hotline. I'll just mention again that I'm speaking with Holly Mullen, the executive director of the Rape Recovery Center, which has partnered with Westminster College on the Not Alone Confronting Sexual Violence on College Campuses Symposium, which will be held on September 19th and 20th at Westminster College. Holly Mullen, executive director of the Rape Recovery Center, thank you very much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Roger.
We had to cut this interview short for airtime, but you can find a full version at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back.